They are Sports Illustrated.
It's amazing.
This incredible body of work.
I really appreciate the integrity.
Everything you do is well done.
You guys do a great job.
We love it. What can we say?
He's Chris Mannix.
He's employed by Sports Illustrated.
The announcer's got it in for me.
There you go.
This is the Crossover NBA Podcast.
You have a problem with it? Build a team that can beat them.
Hosted by the one and only.
Oh, thank God.
Thank God.
Chris Mannix.
All right, welcome back to the next episode of the Crossover NBA Podcast. On this episode, we'll get into the Phoenix Suns and LA Lakers coaching search, the Celtics, how they turned it on in the playoffs, and the Brooklyn Nets, what their next step is as they try to build a contender in Brooklyn. As always, best way to support this podcast, head over to Apple Podcasts where you can post a rating or leave a comment. Maybe you can do both. It's easy. It's free. It is the best way to make sure that we keep doing this podcast week after week. Also, if you like boxing, subscribe to the SI Boxing Podcast hosted by yours truly. That podcast comes out every week. Also, this week, check out my new SI TV show. It's on SI TV. It premiered a couple of weeks ago. Adam Silver was one of my guests. The show will appear on the SI TV platform on Tuesdays and is only available on SI TV. To subscribe, head over to SI.TV. And one of my guests from the show this week is kind enough to stick around and join me here in the podcast studio from the Yes Network, Fox Sports, many other places as well, the great Sarah Kustok. What's up, Sarah?
Mannix, I feel honored. Shows in one day with you? This is a dream.
I'm just grateful you stuck around.
This is a dream.
If this is a dream.
I'm the only person in the building left.
Yes, bring
me in for the podcast.
All right, let's jump into a couple of things here. I want to talk to you first about the first round series with the Celtics and Bucks. And I'm not surprised that it's 1-0 Boston, because I've been a believer in a couple of things with the Celtics. One, that Kyrie Irving's indifference towards the regular season would change into something else in the playoffs. I mean, Kyrie, he came up, you know, his formative years were spent with LeBron James in Cleveland, and that team did not give a damn about the regular season. So I understand to a degree what he was doing throughout the regular season in Boston. And also, I look at what the Celtics went through during the season, specifically when it comes to kind of the minutes envy and the jealousy and everybody looking to get theirs. And I kind of figured, and Danny Ainge and Brad Stevens both convinced me of this too, that all that stuff would kind of go away when it came playoff time, and it was all about winning 16 games and trying to get to a championship level. So the way they're playing didn't surprise me. Now, did I think they'd walk into Milwaukee and win by, 20 or something like that? No, but I thought they would beat the Bucks. What did you think about this series coming in, and what do you think about it now?
I was surprised. I pick the Bucks going in. I still believe that Milwaukee will inevitably win the series. I didn't think it was going to be a sweep or a five guy. I think it will go the distance. But I was surprised. I did not anticipate Boston would be able to come into Milwaukee to shoot that well. The defensive game plan, of which they really did such, not only an incredible job on Giannis, I think that's one factor of it, trying to stop him in the ways in which they met him early, bodied him, put a ton of pressure on him, showed so many bodies, but also negated everyone else. I expected more out of Eric Bledsoe. I thought Chris Middleton did a solid job, but they really, normally you give up one thing to take care of another, and they essentially took away most everything. And Milwaukee predicated so much on how they shoot the three-point shot, so I felt like the fact that they were able to protect the paint, swallow up the inside, protect the rim so well, yet still run different guys off the three-point line and protect the three-point line so well, I was extremely impressed with the Celtics. I do believe we're going to see a very different Bucks team in game two, but a lot's going to need to change because Boston came in and just absolutely rolled.
What's the big adjustment, though, from Milwaukee? Because they can shoot better from beyond the three-point line. That's a big part of what they do. But I was saying coming into this series that Brook Lopez, he was going to be a problem because the Celtics run a lot of pick and pop. And when you have a more versatile big with Al Horford, basically a four-man masquerading as a five, at that five spot, it's going to cause Lopez problems defensively. So unless he's making, you know, 6 3-pointers in a game, he's going to have some problems out there.
Real quick with that, were you surprised that, because Marcus Morris, was he a late switch to the starting lineup, or was that something that you expected to see Stevens move Horford to the five and insert Morris into the starting lineup?
I didn't expect them to move Horford to the five because the Celtics' defensive rating with Aaron Baines at the five,
right,
with Horford at the four is really, really good. So I kind of expect them to keep that going. But I think they did it for exactly what we saw, the ability offensively of Al Horford to exploit Lopez on that end of the floor.
I do think that Horford was very good. I mean, talk about the masterful job he did on the defensive end with the rest of the guys. I don't think that he totally, to me, it wasn't a, you're running Brook Lopez off the court by your exploitation of what you could do in the pick and pop with him. I mean, I do think they took advantage of that, but I also felt like Milwaukee does a lot of drop back sets. What they do with the defense, and in some ways similar to Boston's, make sure to protect the inside, and they didn't want a lot of easy driving lanes. But to your point, the advantage of having Brook Lopez is to space the floor on the offensive end. So if he's not hitting threes, and that's, there was no ability for Milwaukee to space on that end of the floor, and so that was an issue. I mean, even look at the fact that Boston ends up shooting nearly 42% from the three-point line. Jaylen Brown is hitting threes. You expect out of Kyrie Irving. I think Gordon Hayward has always, and you're around it more than anything, but as we talk about Boston through the later parts of the year, he was the big X factor. Mm-hmm. What is he going to look like?
He was their trade deadline acquisition. Like, he was not a good player for most of the first half of the season, and then in the second half, really from around the trade deadline on, he was a different player.
But to your point about Milwaukee and the adjustments, I mean, I think you could expect Mirotić, who did a solid job, and he hit some, you know, some tough shots, some three-point shots, I think early on, to still keep this a game. I think you're going to see him get more minutes. I'm not quite sure. And Connaughton struggled from the field, but I'm not quite sure he'll get the same amount of time. I thought George Hill did a good job coming off the bench, but you know, how deep into the rotation will Budenholzer go? Will you see? I think too, how do you utilize Bledsoe more? You know, how do you put him in more playmaking situations where he has an opportunity to penetrate, to get inside, and to try and loosen up that defense for Giannis? And a lot of what we saw, and at least I did, and some of it was coming off the break or in the early offense, when Giannis has the ball at the top of the key or he's bringing it up the floor, the point of attack allowed for Boston, whether it was Horford or whether it was Baines, to get into him earlier, not give him the runway that we often saw at a different teams doing so because of his limited range. But he had a wall, and any time he thought he had an opening, that's where I think Boston, and again, you see this so much, they impress me so much because they're so smart about, you know, whether it's traps or it'll be late help, or they'll stunt, or it's the different nuances of, okay, we're not just going to double team this guy every single time. It's where that double team is coming from, when they're sending a guy, when they're switching off of a play. And I think for Milwaukee, a lot of it is going to be looking at that, and for Mike Budenholzer to look at, okay, how did they defensively attack us in different ways or different spots on the floor that we haven't necessarily seen from other teams?
Yeah, and that's the adjustment with Budenholzer and with Giannis, who both said after the games, like, you know, Boston did a great job on us defensively, and it was a different look. I mean, the Celtics historically have said, you know, Semi Ojeleye, go on out there, do your best, and we'll see what happens. We'll defend everybody else. We don't really mind if Giannis gets 25 or 30 in the game as long as everybody else doesn't get it. This time, it was late double teams. It was that kind of wall out there with arms everywhere. And I don't know what the final number was on just overall shots outside of like 18 feet, but Giannis took too many of them. Like, he was towards the end of that game pulling up from three. The Celtics will live with that.
And the fact that he's 3 of 5 from the three-point line and still has a game where, mm-hmm, you feel like he didn't do enough offensively, I mean, that should be icing on the cake. That should be a situation where if I looked at just that line, I would think, man, he must have had a monster game if he was hitting threes in that capacity. I'll always remember, and just in talking, again, you're on the inside of this, but those from inside the Boston organization or just through the years, and the thing that has always stuck out to me about their defense, and you know, I don't understand all the nuances of it, but offensively, throughout you talk so much about reads, read and react, and how you read different defenses and making plays and the decision, the kind of free-flowing offense that you could find. And I would always hear about Boston having reads defensively. And you see that because they have high IQ players on the defensive end where they're making reads off of what they're going to do. And, you know, the connectivity of that group was something that I hadn't seen throughout the course of the year. I think that was a big reason why they come into the year as, you know, expected to win the East or at least be on top of the East. And some of that chemistry may have been lost throughout the year, but now you're seeing a lot of that. However, I think you believe that Boston is the more talented team. I still have a ton of faith in how Giannis will respond, in ways that he can be put in better positions to be effective. And also, I think Bledsoe will come back with a different look in how he can attack offensively. Middleton, I still have a great amount of confidence in their depth and in a lot of the players that I think will shoot better, especially in game two being back at home.
Well, use the word confidence. And, you know, Giannis is clearly the best player on the floor on both sides. But after that, in terms of players you have confidence in playing well, Boston might have two or three of the next group of guys. I mean, definitely Kyrie. Al Horford, I think, is in that mix.
Yes.
Has Hayward reached the point of being confident what he's going to be able to do? I mean, Jason Tatum stunk out the joint. Like, he didn't even play well. And they, you know, he's their second best scorer on that team. He doesn't play well, and they still win by 20-plus.
Well, and that's where, you know, Giannis, obviously, you put in that list. Chris Middleton, I trust a ton, and I think that he's a consistent performer. That's where you go back to, and I'm not sure where, again, when you're not in the mix with this group day in, day out, but Eric Bledsoe, I would assume that George Hill coming off the bench. I think that's what makes this series so much fun, because you could look down the rosters and both teams, a big part of their strength is their depth. And so I think that poses a lot of questions to it. And maybe Brad Stevens has a better handle with his roster, you know, the guys he's going to use, but it questions how far into the rotation do you go? How many minutes are you playing some of these reserve players when you may want to heavy load your starters, your key guys, throughout the course of right now, when this is, you know, the final stretch of your season?
How much pressure in your mind is on Giannis in a situation like this? Because he is young and he's going to have a lot of opportunities, but he was the number one seed this year, the Bucks. He's probably going to be the MVP this year. I mean, does he open himself up for criticism if the Bucks go down in this series?
I have a different perspective on Giannis from that, because I feel like he's just been, we didn't necessarily have him in the conversation throughout the course of last year, or even the last 2 years, of the LeBrons and Kawhi Leonards and Kevin Durant's and Steph Curry's. I feel like he's getting it. He's obviously there right now, but I think this year was the year he busted through to that point. I imagine he puts a lot of pressure on himself, the expectations that he has within. I don't necessarily I think a lot of it is going to rely on those complimentary players, those other guys on Milwaukee. I think anytime you look at the Bucks, Giannis can thrive if those guys are doing their jobs, if they're contributing in the ways that you would expect, with hitting outside shots or still able to create and to play make. And so to me, a lot of it rests more on some of those other guys, the Middletons, the Bledsoes. We'll see if, you know, I think it, you know, Marcus Smart, of course, is out for Boston. It doesn't help for the Bucks that Malcolm Brogdon's been playing. We'll see, yeah, you know, if he could return during this series. But, you know, I think at any point when you're at that elite of a level, you will receive criticism if you're not winning, if you're not, in fact, advancing. But I also think because the expectations have been so high for Boston, because they have a all-star in Kyrie Irving, I don't think it's necessarily would be looked at as some massive failure, despite the fact that, you know, they were the best record in the NBA throughout the year.
Yeah, I think what it does do is it makes the front office examine the roster, and they're like, we're predicting their demise one game into the series.
I was going to say, I want to make sure I'm not still riding with Milwaukee.
I think they win game two, and I think they've proven they can do great things. So I think that the series is far from over. But in this hypothetical, you know, I wrote before the whole Eastern Conference semi started, like, there's so much at stake for all four of these teams. Like, the future of the franchises could be at stake. And I thought Milwaukee was on the sturdiest ground because Giannis is tied up for a few more years and they kind of control these players to a degree if they pay them. But you're going to wind up committing to this roster this offseason. And you have to decide if, you know, coming close to Max with Chris Middleton or Max is the right thing to do. Malcolm Brogdon's going to get some big offers out there because of the way he's played the last couple of years. You're going to have to make some tough choices and decide if this is the group that you want to move forward with, or do you try to get creative and put different types of players around Giannis?
Well, in that's the thing about putting it around Giannis. You want to make sure, and Giannis has expressed nothing but happiness of being Milwaukee. The
organization. I hope he's the first guy that, like, because like Kevin Durant did it back in like 2010 with Oklahoma City. Like, why are you guys all joining with Miami? Like, form your own teams. And then he goes
from everything he says, it appears that way. But it's a factor in that, you know, making sure that the roster is still built around him in a way in which he feels confident that they can compete for a title. And obviously, you see the competitive nature of Giannis and just how he speaks and the improvements he's made, and just, you know, and that's where I think, you know, when you ask about how much pressure is on him, do I think he puts a ton of pressure on himself because he has such high expectations of himself? Absolutely. But I think he has got so much more room to go to improve. It's not just, to me, it's not even just about his perimeter shot or extending his range. You know, he is just, he's still has come so far, but he's got unlimited potential with his God-given abilities and just his physical gifts, but also his basketball mind that you could tell continues to grow because he's putting in the work and he's putting in the study.
One thing I think he has to figure out, and I had a coach text me during the game the other night, he's only had one playoff series under his belt. And they allow a different brand of physicality in the postseason. And, you know, he's complained a little bit about some of the calls he's not getting. He's got to learn and get better at playing through playoff contact, I think. I think that the physicality that the Celtics...
You mean this year, this season?
This year. I mean, like, no, this series, just through game one, and it's just you know this, it's a different brand of contact you get. In the regular season, a lot of stuff gets called. In the playoffs, let a lot of stuff go. Like, you know, you're allowed to bang and grab, and you've got to power through stuff sometimes. I think that's something that you can only learn through experience, and maybe a series like this is educational, win or lose.
Oh, absolutely. And just how to play against different looks. I mean, we've heard it from everyone, just that Giannis has seen different looks even out of that first game that he saw throughout the course of the first round series and, you know, just overall. And I think that matters. That makes a difference. And for a player that's absorbing that and soaking up that and just seeing different players. I mean, just think about playing against a Aaron Baines as opposed to an Al Horford. Those two guys in and of themselves are such entirely different players. And so how do you approach that? And then additionally, going against a team that obviously everything is predicated on stopping Giannis, but a collective effort, the type of help that's coming from the other players and players, too, that are physical, that are versatile, that are athletic, that are quick. So that is, I think, a part of the experience and part of the growth for a guy like him.
Still riding with the Bucks then? Bucks.
Yeah, and that's no disrespect. I think Boston's incredible. I am so excited. When I tell you, when Saturday came and I knew that the weekend would consist of watching Philly-Toronto and the Bucks and Celtics and even the Warriors and Houston.
Some nerd weekend time right there.
I'm a little more excited about the Eastern Conference. But no, but I think any four of these teams, it's fun to watch because they all have their strengths. But yeah, I'm very high on Milwaukee, and a lot of that is because I do think that we're going to see a different Giannis throughout the rest of this series now that he's seen some things out of the Celtics.
All right, let's talk about the Western Conference. The Rockets-Warriors opened up over the weekend. The Warriors took game one of that series. Impressive win because the Rockets were rested. They were playing great basketball, and they're going into a series where they have a lot of confidence. You know, they played the Warriors as well as any team in the league over the last couple of years. They lose that game, and they kind of compounded it after the fact by griping a little bit too much about the officiating. There was the report in The Athletic, Sam Amick, that there was some, you know, there was a data-driven report that was submitted to the NBA about the number of fouls that were missed against them going back to the playoffs last year. What did you make of all that? Not just the way that how the Rockets lost, but the aftermath of it and the complaining about the officiating.
I'm not big, and this is not directed just towards the Rockets, just in general. I am not a big fan of complaining about officiating. I think these individuals are not robots. They are trying their very best. They go through just a diligent process to even get to the point where they're at. Show me a professional sports league or any league for that matter where you believe that the officials are always right on every call. They're going to make mistakes. That's a part of it. And we see throughout the course of the regular season, the postseason, how closely they're graded and critiqued. They're watching film. So with all of that being said, were there a couple calls in the first half with in regards to James Harden and giving a shooter room to land, and, you know, calls that we've seen in protecting the shooter throughout the whole regular season that were fairly consistent that weren't called early on. Yeah, but the calls in the second half I thought were different. I thought overall there's going to be calls that are missed, and I think after that game, it's your first game of the second round, we understand the importance that it was to Houston. If there was a game that they needed to get and could have got and probably felt like was in their hand, it was that one. But I hope, because I'm a fan of the Rockets and how they play and how they're challenging a team like the Warriors, I hope more of that was just them feeling like they wanted to gripe, they wanted to get off their chest, and it's not in their heads. Because to me, in watching parts of the second half or at the end of the game, they were carrying too much of the past thought of trying to initiate contact, get fouls, what the officials were doing, than just playing. Because, God, I mean, they're an extraordinary group of talented players. So when they just play, it's a great matchup. But yeah, I'm just not big after the fact into the complaining or going back at it. That's just, I feel like the officials are trying their best. You say your piece, but let it go, because it's not going to change anything.
I agree that the officials are better than the perception is of them, because every time a coach or a player complains, doesn't mean they're right.
Right.
I mean, they're, more often than not, they're wrong, and that the ball did go off them, or they didn't really get fouled. There are two things, though, that I'd like to see cleaned up, both in this Rockets-Warriors series and moving forward. The first is the area to land and what is a foul and what isn't. You called most of the Nets games this year. All season long, you get into that shooter's space.
Even close to it.
Close to it. It's a foul.
Yeah.
Like, it is an automatic whistle. And I saw Klay Thompson three times in the first half against James Harden step into his space, and, you know, he fell down as a and Harden fell down as a result of it. That's a foul. No matter if it's James Harden or Klay Thompson, I don't care who it is, that is a foul by the letter of the rule the NBA has been following all season long. And people might say Harden jumps forward, he spreads his legs out. Yes, he does, but not on those plays. Those were pretty blatant and egregious errors, I thought. I'd like to see some clarity with that, and that called in a uniform way. The other thing is these late whistles. There are a lot of late whistles out there.
Yeah.
And it seems like the referees are waiting to see if the ball goes in or has a chance to go in before blowing the whistle. I don't think you can operate like that. I think it's either a foul or it's not. And if you decide that you're going to let a little more contact go, I'm actually okay with that. I like to see the game flow a little bit more. Let guys play through some stuff a little bit more. But don't, I mean, there were a handful of times, Sarah, that the ball was like in the hands of the opposing team and they're about to start a break and the whistle blows. That, to me, was perplexing.
It incites even more anger and, I think, frustration from players when it is a late whistle. Because it's one thing thinking that was an incorrect call or a bad call or I didn't foul. When you hear it late, and to your point, when they're already heading down to the other end, that changes kind of the perception of things. But I think those, I'm curious to see now as we head into game two, how is the officiating change? Is it called any different, given the fact that there's been so much dialogue, so much narrative now surrounding it?
Yeah. And if you're Houston, there's a lot of pressure on you. Now, next year, you might be able to go into the season as a co-favorite because your team is probably going to stay intact.
Yeah.
And the Warriors, they might get broken up there. But this is still a Rockets team that is coming into this series with a lot of confidence. And if they can't get it done this year, I mean, this might be their last chance to... I mean, it probably is their last chance to knock off this version of Golden State, but it's going to be a lot of disappointing people in Houston if they can't get it done this year.
But we'll see what happens in game two. I mean, look at the fact that they lost by 4 points.
Having a tremendous overreaction to game one. At least I am. Like, I'm ready to, like, bury the Rockets, so we're going to bury the Bucks too.
That's how I feel like you're having with the Milwaukee-Boston series. No, but this is a Houston team. I mean, they shot under 30% from three. And you know, the one aspect I look at, I thought Golden State, especially early on, really sloppy. I mean, the fact that Houston was able to get 20 points off of turnovers and, you know, the Warriors were careless with it. To me, the level of engagement for the Warriors, and I know Steve Kerr always says this, you know, anyone covering the team says this, is you can kind of get a gauge of how focused they are by how they're taking care of the basketball. So the disappointment of losing, yes, I'm sure sits with the Rockets, but they should still feel just as confident as they were coming into game two, because they played far from a perfect game and they still were right there in position to win. So I think I think it's going to be interesting, but I think going back to that, I'm curious how much they're actually carrying. You know, will they use it as motivation that they felt like they didn't get the calls they wanted in game one, or are they going to let that dictate how they play and change some of the ways in which they play in game two?
All right, let's talk about some of the coaching openings that are out there. Two in particular, out west, the Lakers and the Suns. Now, it seems like both these teams have kind of either zeroed in on Monty Williams or put him at either 1 or 1A on their hiring list. Williams still the assistant right now with the Philadelphia 76ers. But it made me think over the last couple of days, you never would think you'd believe this, that the Suns' job might be better than the Lakers' job. But the Lakers right now are kind of in a weird place. LeBron James is in his mid-30s. The rest of the roster is, you know, in their early 20s. You've got cap space, but you're not at the top of anybody's list that I know of in terms of signing there in the offseason. Whereas with Phoenix, you do have the meddlesome owner in Robert Sarver. It has been a coaching graveyard over the last 5 years, but you do have Devin Booker signed to a long-term deal. You have DeAndre Ayton, who's not going to win Rookie of the Year, but put up Rookie of the Year type numbers. I mean, he was never on TV because he plays for the Suns, but he put up some pretty good numbers.
He was impressive
with the Suns this year. And come mid-May, you might have the number one overall pick, or at least a pick that likely winds up inside that top three. So I think it's a lot closer than people think. I mean, is it possible that the Suns could be as good or better a coaching job than the LA Lakers?
I'm not sure I would say better. And I think a lot of it rests on what your priorities are when you're looking for a head coaching job. And if you have the opportunity, if Monty Williams does, to really have your pick of the two, because you look at the Los Angeles Lakers, and despite what's gone on in some of the ways in which it seems like they're not entirely on the same page and on the same track, they're the Los Angeles Lakers. And I do still believe that holds a cachet. Their intent is to compete for a championship. They still have one of the greatest players to ever play the game, and they have cap space. And to your point, who's going to come there? Who can they get? I'm not sure, but there is opportunity there. You're uncertain, though, what the roster will look like. Those expectations are going to be sky high. And so there's a lot of pressure that comes along with that. What will the front office look like? Who are you going, you know, to be kind of beholden to when you're making decisions, when you're coaching, and who it is that you're actually answering to? And I think that all of that is questions you need to look at. But then on the flip side of things with the Phoenix Suns, you know, ownership aside, of which there's a lot of questions in that regard, you got some young talent. You went through it, and Booker and Ayton and a lottery pick and the potential of who you may get, a team that has some cap space and has some room, a location like the Phoenix, you know, area. I've talked about that. I don't know if anyone cares that you can get a tan in the winter, maybe golf a little bit. Not that you'd have time. But, you know,
looking forward to retirement, are you?
But already. you know, but with job security, yeah, it's been a carousel of head coaches coming through. But if you can get a team into, you know, even playoff contention, if you can make the play, I mean, the ceiling or the expectations early on isn't quite as high as you would face when you're going to Los Angeles. So, and I'm not sure, you know, if you're, what do you care most about? Do you want a position where you are potentially, you know, relied upon to try and compete for a title? And that, I think, is all questions that, to me, I think it's, I don't think one is better than the other. I think they're just very different. And, you know, you're looking at a roster that you're expecting to have experienced guys, a few young players, you know, still in, assuming Lonzo Ball and Kyle Kuzma are still there, Brandon Ingram, but with LeBron James, potentially some other more veteran players, or a very young group in Phoenix that you think that you can develop and, you know, kind of work through their rebuilding process. So it's a great question. But I think a lot of it comes down to what are your priorities and what do you care about most in taking one of those positions?
There's just not a lot of stability in either situation. I mean,
and really in coaching in the NBA, when is there?
Well, no, I mean stability above.
But you're right.
Like,
no.
You know, I mean, with front offices, like you go into some meetings, and if you meet with the Spurs, you know, let's say like Pop retires after this year, which I don't think he's going to do, but let's say whenever he walks away, you've still got R.C. Buford there, the Holt family. Like, you've got some stability that you know you can trust the people.
Do you think it feels that way, though, with Jeannie Buss?
No, I don't. I think Jeannie is, she's not exactly distinguishing herself in my eyes. I mean, it's just,
you know, you hire Magic and Rob Pelinka, I get it. Magic Johnson, you're continuing kind of a longstanding tradition of your family of hiring ex-Lakers. And Magic is this charismatic figure that you would think would have a pretty good basketball mind. And you balance that out by trying to find the next Neil Olshey or the next Bob Myers, the next ex-agent to jump into the executive ranks and succeed. So I got that. But then when it fizzled, you'd think she'd want to go in a different direction and go out for the best name available. Like, they can write any of these GMs a blank check and say, come work with us. Sam Presti, come work with us. R.C. Buford, come work with us. Bob Myers, come work with us. Bob's got UCLA ties. And it doesn't seem, at least from my understanding, that they've made overtures to really anybody, that they're happy with the current dynamic of Rob Pelinka running the show and weirdly the Rambuses being involved with all this. You've got Linda Rambus, who's an advisor to Jeannie Buss. You've got Kurt Rambus, who's doing something with the Lakers front office, working with Rob Pelinka. Maybe at some point he'll be an associate coach. Maybe he'll be an assistant general manager. They just seem to keep looking internally for solutions to their problems when you're the Lakers. Like, if you're a different team, you could say, all right, we're a small market team. We can't get that guy. We don't want to spend a lot of money, whatever. The Lakers can spend as much money as they want. I've said this before, $180 million per year in a TV deal. They're worth $3.7 billion. There's a lot you can do with that type of resource, and you're still the Lakers. Like, you've got great cachet. You've got the history of that team. There are, and I know this for a fact, there are a lot of top quality GMs out there that would be very interested in talking to the Lakers about their job. Very interested in talking to them. But yet the Lakers just seem to be content at going this route. And I don't know if you're Monty Williams, you know what the mess it is in Phoenix. Like, Sarver's there, new GM and James Jones. I think Jeff Bowers kind of added some stability in that mix. But the Lakers, like, I mean, I can't imagine what that meeting was like with what was Jesse Buss there? Like, you know, there was the Busses, the Rambuses, Pelinka. Like, what is he looking at? How is he looking at this front office and saying, all right, this makes sense to me. This is a group that's going to help me succeed when I succeed.
And I'm not even sure it makes sense to them. Like, do they even have regardless of who it is, can they lay out their structure of power? Can they lay out who's making decisions on what? And that's where, and I don't know if for example, Amani Williams goes it, like, does he have leverage? Because if he is their top candidate, in fact, their top candidate, or if Ty Lue, do they have the leverage to go in and kind of lay out their plan and their vision and the decisions they're going to make? What say will they have in personnel, like, and who you're bringing in? And so I'm not sure if that's an area to leverage in. I don't know if they, you know, trust what it is that they're hearing back. But I think those are all aspects of it. And I think any time when, to your point of kind of a lack of stability, whether it's with the front office or the way the organization is run, but also just even your own position, in what position do you feel like you're going to go to a place and have the proper amount of support and stability to have a little bit of leeway? And is there even leeway? You know, you look at the Los Angeles Lakers, they felt like they should have been potentially competing for a title last season, or at least making the playoffs, at least being in one of those top four spots. So what are their expectations going into this year, given the fact that there's a lot of question marks what their roster will look like?
I mean, if you're Jeannie Buss too, don't you want to, you know, spend the capital needed to spend to go out there and get a Presti or some type of GM like that? Because then you can just be an owner. Do what Peter Holt did. Like, all right, I got RC and Pop. I'm going to enjoy myself for the next two decades.
Totally agree. But that feels off the table now, right? Like, does it feel like this is the way?
Once they got into the interview process with the coaches, it became very clear that Rob Pelinka was the guy.
And so if that's the situation, then you need to be comfortable stepping into that. You need to be comfortable being it. But with that being said, then at least, you know, I would like to, then you feel like, okay, I'm Rob Pelinka's guy. I'm this front office's guy, and it's not that situation of, you know, the kind of precarious state Luke Walton was in of where throughout the course of his tenure with Magic Johnson and Rob Pelinka that he wasn't necessarily quote-unquote their guy, and that presented some issues.
Yeah, well, it's a little, still a messy situation. And plus, if you're...
What job would you take?
I'd probably take Phoenix. And that's kind of rolling the dice, assuming they get the number one pick. Or even number two. If you're the Suns, number two is not bad for you either, because you probably take John Morant there. And, you know, you spent the entire year with, like, open tryouts for point guard.
Right.
That wasn't a good point guard spit. And that's part of the reason that Igor Kokoskov struggled out there. I mean, he you know, people, you know, griped about his in-game play calling. I saw a lot of that and strategy and whatever. But when you don't have a point guard, it's almost impossible to win in this league.
Right.
Like, you have to have great players at every other position if you're going to win without a point guard. It is the most important position in the NBA. And for most of the season, they didn't have anybody out there. It was, you know, Booker was playing some point guard at times. I'd for the right deal, I'd lean towards Phoenix. I really would. I don't know. All right, let me go back to the Eastern Conference for a quick second. We talk about the Celtics and the Bucks. We're recording this before the Raptors and Sixers game too, but I said going to the playoffs that the Raptors are the team to beat, and this is like playing out exactly as I kind of felt it might, with Kawhi kind of going into playoff Kawhi mode, and all the gifts the Raptors have, you know, kind of being showcased out there. I mean, Kyle Lowry had a stinker in game one of the last round, played better in game one of this series against Philadelphia. But I look at Kawhi and Siakam as two lockdown defensive players at their positions on the wing, and both guys had great offensive game ones. Ibaka played well. Marc Gasol played well. This is a team, Sarah, that is deep, that is talented, that has a guy that's going to be the best player on the floor in most of the series that he plays in Kawhi Leonard. And we have to remember, like, we talk about their playoff failures a lot. They've lost to one team and one guy over the last, like, 3 or 4 years. What do you think make of the Raptors and the way they played in the postseason?
I've been impressed. And I think when you talk about the past playoff failures of Toronto, like, this is fresh blood. I think Dwayne Casey did an excellent job. But Nick Nurse has got, he's got a swagger about him. He came in with an approach this season of trying. Everything was getting ready for the postseason. Yeah, they had a great regular season, but I feel like the way in which he tinkered with lineups and combinations, trying different schemes throughout the course of the year, he was getting ready for things he would need to do throughout the course of the postseason. And I think with Kawhi Leonard leading the way, so much pressure now, and I understand DeMar DeRozan was in part with Kyle Lowry, but I feel like so much pressure has been taken off Lowry. There's not even that much, you know, when you're looking at it breaking down who really is expected to carry a lot of the load, that goes to Kawhi Leonard. Pascal Siakam has taken over that. And for all the questions of if the regular season Siakam was going to carry into the postseason, goodness gracious, like it almost feels like he's taken it up a notch.
That's the first goodness gracious on the podcast.
Goodness gracious. Have first. I not said that yet?
I don't think so.
No. You mean forever?
Ever. Oh, yeah, ever.
Oh,
yeah.
I say goodness gracious often. I don't cuss a lot. Okay. That's what I might go to. But he's been tremendous. And to your point, when you've got a team that, yeah, offensively is very talented, but defensively, the way that they could lock down, the versatility they have. I mean, you didn't even mention, like, Danny Green, mm-hmm. You got a guy like him, but also championship pedigree. And so for Leonard and Green, having been there before, the pickup of Marc Gasol, and, you know, we've seen what he did in just game one against Joel Embiid. I'll be curious to see how Embiid comes back tonight. But, like, just how you could play with him and how Ibaka has embraced the fact that, okay, now I'm coming off the bench. It doesn't seem like there's any egos involved with this group. I think, you know, you'll continue to kind of keep looking at that rotation and the bench of what Van Vliet does and what Norm Powell and how they continue to be productive. But it's an impressive group, and it goes back to the fact that they get it done on both ends of the floor. I think they could play in transition and play in the half court. And they're a deep group, and there's options to go with given the combinations you want to have on the floor.
This is one of the more interesting off seasons in the NBA because of the potential for seismic changing movement out there. And Kawhi Leonard's kind of at the top of that. I'd be very interested to see, you know, if this Raptors team gets to the finals, and if they get through a series against Philadelphia, they'll be favored against either Boston or Milwaukee, I think, in the next round. If you get to the finals with the Raptors, could Kawhi Leonard really walk away from a finals team? I mean, everybody hears the Clippers rumors, I'm sure you have as well.
Yeah.
Like, it's all out there. Could he actually walk away from not just a team that gets to the finals, but a team that's built to keep doing that? I mean, some of the young guys on that team, I mean, Siakam's probably going to win most improved this year. Fred VanVleet's a player. Yes, Kyle Lowry's starting to slide a little bit. Who knows if Marc Gasol, what he's going to look like in the future.
But I feel like a guy like Lowry, like his volume of shooting has gone down. But some of the passes he had in game one, like the way he sees the floor, the way he runs and organizes things, the defender that I think he can be in certain scenarios is just, you know, even with his height, but how he posts a fit, like there's a whole variety of things. So back to your question, I don't, in what do I know? I mean, we all hear the rumors and we talk to different people and everyone's convinced that they have the answers. I think you...
So convinced. There's so many people convinced that they know what's happening.
If I could tell you the amount of people that say they're on the inside mm-hmm. and will tell me 100% that this is what's happening, I'm like, I'm not even sure. But that goes back, and I always feel this way about these players. Like, I don't think until the actual season ends, when they are done playing, and maybe even weeks after, do they truly know? Or even if they think that they know, things can change so easily. With Kawhi, I will say this, we all hear the LA rumors. Throughout the whole season, and every time I've had a Toronto game, I talk to a lot of people from there, they are very convinced, and there's people within the organization that are very convinced that he will stay. Mm-hmm. And so, again, for whatever that's worth, but I do think they feel like the comfort level that he's shown, the way in which he's embraced the city, embraced the organization, his teammates, the relationships that they have built. So I don't know. And to be honest, I don't. My opinion is that I don't necessarily think, assuming they get to the Eastern Conference Final, I don't think a lot of it is predicated on what happened. I don't think it's if they get to the NBA Final that he will definitely stay, or if they don't get to this point that he'll definitely leave. I think for an individual like Kawhi, for the talent that he has, for the impact that he can have on a team and for this group, I think it'd be more than that and bigger than that, and that won't necessarily make him stay or go either way.
Anybody that says they know what Kawhi Leonard is thinking is just wrong. Like, I've done multiple profiles on this guy, and I barely know him. Like, there's just, he is, you know, just a wall when it comes to letting people inside. And the Raptors have done things right. I mean, they have treated him in the same way Oklahoma City treated Paul George. He has been, every day, been looped in on the decision-making thinking, and he's been treated like a franchise player.
Well, and the thing you always hear is his trust in the medical staff. Like, how big of a factor that is in, you know, a great medical staff, the trust he has with them.
He's been healthy all year. Yeah. And they brought in Jeremy Castleberry, who's an assistant coach there now. And Jeremy's an excellent basketball coach. Like, he was in the San Antonio system, but he's Kawhi's closest friend. And, you know, that, I think that's a factor in all this as well. But, it's just... You know, without even reading tea leaves or hearing anything, like, if they get to the finals, like, can you actually walk away from that? And if they get to the finals, they'll have more than a puncher's chance of winning. I mean,
yes.
Because that's a team built to play against a Golden State or even a Houston with the defensive players they have on the perimeter. It's going to be interesting.
But with many players, and you look, Kawhi could think, that's awesome, and this was incredible, and all of you in Toronto were fantastic to me, but I also believe that I can go to the Clippers mm-hmm. now and go win a title there with that group. So I think there's a lot of moving parts, and to your point, I don't think anyone can get inside a player's head and necessarily know.
The Clippers had a great audition in the playoffs, winning two games off Golden State.
Fantastic.
And they can say to a Durant or to a Kawhi, look, plug you right into that spot, that Gallinari spot, and, you know, we're a different team. We're, you know, especially with the Golden State likely to break up, we're a totally different team out there.
And they signed Doc to an extension?
Yeah, I mean, they're going to be impressive in the room.
Yeah.
Like, they're going to be really impressive in the room. Can't let you go without a Nets question here. The Nets, good season, you know, make the playoffs. Remarkable what they did without those first-round picks that the Celtics, you know, pilfered off them for several years.
You had
years.
To get that in?
I did, yeah. Sorry, Billy. But a really good year. They make the playoffs. They've got some solid cornerstone pieces there. I mean, Caris LeVert's a player. D'Angelo Russell had a terrific year and a contract year, no less. Jared Allen has ups and downs in the playoffs, but he's a good piece to have there. What's the next step for Brooklyn? What do they have to do, either free agency or internally, to take that to a playoff team, to a team that can win a series?
I think for the Nets, and obviously I'm on the inside in a certain level of bias, but more than anything that I've been blown away by that they have done so quickly, and that's from ownership to the front office, performance staff, coaching staff, I mean, Sean Marks and Kenny Atkinson, I can't say enough good things about, but they have established a culture, and that's a buzzword that gets tossed around, and culture here, we want to build a it is real, you can feel it. The, you know, from the practice facility to Barclays Center to the atmosphere and fan base, like, the fan base is, it's a legitimate fan base that now I think you can build upon. So there's all the pieces that you would need to try and lure a free agent, whether or not they get the pieces this summer. I think what they have established is something that they should feel very excited about. And you mentioned the cornerstones. That can't go on. I mean, Caris LeVert, you got Spencer Dinwiddie, who just turned 26. Caris LeVert's 24. Jared Allen just turned 21. D'Angelo Russell, I think that's going to be a big decision, both for Russell himself and for the organization, what they do with him if they're able to bring him back. He had an excellent and all-star year, but I think also just the person that he's become, more the leadership that he's shown, he's been just a pleasure to be around for everyone. But I think now making sure that you're moving forward. And it may, from the outside, have been a surprise that they made it to the playoffs. I think internally, or at least from the players' perspective, they believed that they were one of the top teams in the Eastern Conference. But making sure that you're taking steps forward. They dealt with some injuries this year, but can they compete for that? They were the sixth spot this year, but can they compete for that 5-6 spot next year? Can they extend a series? Can they find a way to bring in players that might help them get, closer to the top of the Eastern Conference? But we've seen a lot of savvy strategic moves from Sean Marks, not only in getting back draft picks, but the trades that he's made to get pieces. Now I think we're going to see who do they target, who do they try and go for in some of those positions of need and the power forward spot, to really now not just look at, okay, who's the best player available for us, but how do they fit the personnel now that we have and in just the track that they're on at this point.
What do you think the thinking is about Russell? Because he's probably going to get a big-time offer this offseason.
I think it's all about, it goes back, and this is just my perspective. It's not necessarily their thinking, but I think they were overly impressed with his maturity and his poise. Obviously, he showed the production on the court, but more than anything, just the way in which he bought into the big picture in, everything being something bigger than him. But I do think that there's a price, and I think it depends on the price from the outside. I think it depends on how much does D'Angelo himself value what the organization has done to develop him to get to this point. I think he's got an extraordinary relationship with Kenny Atkinson, who has coached him tough, coached him hard, but it is awesome to watch how those two feed off one another, and you watch him whether it's in practice or during the game, and, will he find that in another place? So I do think D'Angelo values those things. I think he enjoys being in New York. I think those are all going to play a part of it, and, how much do the dollars actually matter, mm-hmm. And a couple million dollars here, that will that make a difference of having him say, I may go elsewhere because of the number, or does he think that he's got the right number in the right place and in a place that he can best excel?
One thing I'm curious about with that team is, if they can't get one of the marquee guys to commit there, will they try to spend their capital anyway? Because that's one thing that Sean Marks has done, is he's kind of been saved from himself a couple of times. I mean, the Tyler Johnson contract, the Otto Porter contract. He was saved by Allen Crabbe, then he went and traded for him anyway and went out and got him. Is there a patient mindset there that if we don't get the guy that we want, that we're okay kind of building organically on the group that we have? Or do you think there's a sense of urgency?
No, I definitely don't think there's a sense of urgency, just because you have more trust and confidence in the pieces you do have. So I think there is a patience, but I also think there's a humble confidence in the type of players that they can get. And I think, there's obviously tiers of free agents and different tiers of the levels of guys you can get. So I'm not sure who they start to target, who they really can get. And I think that's all a part of it. But I think they've been, you mentioned a handful of contracts, and I do think that, some of those have worked out well to maybe, that they have been matched mm-hmm. by other teams. But I also think overall, more of the decisions have been on the patient side and in the side of that we're not looking. We already tried with the home runs, that was in the past prior to the Sean Marks era. And it's more about making sure you're continue to build in the right way, because there's no rush, especially at this point, there is no rush, to get to a place that they feel like they're trending in the right direction, kind of trending in the speed that they expect.
I like Tobias Harris there a lot.
I love Tobias. I mean, he's
3-point shooter on that group. Like, that's exactly what you need.
The fit, the personality too. Yeah. I think just
he's
the,
young
the
enough
character
too. He fits into that mold. I think, what's he, mid
26? Yeah, 26, 27.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
Position of need, yeah.
Yeah, position of need right there.
He'd be a good one. He'd be a good one. We'll see.
Sarah, always appreciate your time coming in here. Get some sleep. I know you've been up. I know what time those first thing first calls are, so yes.
You got one tomorrow morning.
Right and early. They send those text messages with topics very early. Appreciate you taking some time to come in doing
thanks for
this
having
and
me.
The SITV show, so I appreciate it.
Hopefully I'll be back again soon.
Yes, appreciate that.